foremost people really thought there were major threats and about the possibility of a bioterrorist attack. I thought maybe she was getting information and being manipulated, and this maybe would be over the top. That's why she got a Pulitzer Prize, because it turned out there was 9/11. Okay, Michael, so it runs both ways with us in this business. You know, you take chances when you take risks doing reporting, particularly what we call investigative reporting. You take chances when you deal with people confidential in a confidential source situation, and there are all kinds of consequences for that.
Shut the hell up, Lowell Bergman. This nonsense about when Judy Miller was doing stories on Al-Qaeda before 9/11 and the bio-warfare issues, I thought she was going over the top. But in your mind, she proved right on top of it after 9/11 actually hit. What the hell does Judith Miller from the New York Times little reports with her Al-Qaeda buddies have to do with the setting up by Sam, or at the very least, letting the 9/11 hits happen? These are two different things. And then you talk about, wait a minute, let me just break it down like this. Judith Miller and the rest of them are doing what they're supposed to do, making up stories as henchmen for the U.S. Empire. We'll do what we have to do when we put those types in their grave. You know what time it is, slave time. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe, slave revolt time. Tonight, we're going to venture into corporate media land and deal with none other than Judith Miller, her recent trials and tribulations. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth? The media. The media. The media. The media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth?
They lie.
For a small planet.
MCI. The global internet became their trading floor.
Automatically builds your credit card of choice. pay for everything that bad?
Now things are about to get out of hand. And for people like these, an incredible weapon has been created.
Power of a computer in the palm of your hand.
You know what time it is. Ventures in corporate media land. And tonight, we're going to deal with New York Times reporter Judith Miller. You know, the world has been spun on its head when Judith Miller, the corporate military henchman for the Pentagon and the Fourth Estate, is portrayed as a journalist fighting to protect her sources with some kind of sincerity. This basically this basically deals with the fact that recently she's been under indictment for the whole Valerie Plame situation. Now, she didn't actually release the information on Valerie Plame. Valerie Plame is the CIA operative, and her name was released by Robert Novak, basically by the Pentagon paying back Plame's husband for countering Boy George on the fact that there was no that Saddam was not trying to buy uranium from the country of Niger. Well, Valerie Plame was one of the people who, it turns out, was contacted, even though she didn't write a story on it. It appears now that the federal government has been trying to twist her arm to release her sources on who may have told her, if anyone, about Valerie Plame. So she now is trying to hold steadfast as a defender of sources, as if she has any integrity. And recently she was found guilty of not turning over this confidential source information and was given 18 months. It's in appeals right now. So she's been touring around talking about the issue and playing the role of a journalist with integrity. Michael Krasny, who has a show on KQED, the little liberal show, you know, Forum, he recently had on Judy Miller and Lowell Berkman. And they go over some aspects of her particular career. We're going to venture into this corporate media land dilemma and work out the reality from there. So first, let's explore how the discussion first starts off with Krasny, Valerie Plame, Krasny, Judith Miller, and Lowell Berkman. So check this out.
So let me welcome Judith Miller, who is a journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner, as I said.
national security correspondent with the New York Times, who joins us from UC Berkeley. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us this morning is Lowell Bergman, also a journalist and a Pulitzer Prize winning one, an investigative reporter with the New York Times, producer correspondent for the PBS documentary series Frontline, and longtime friend of the Forum program. Welcome, Lowell.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here as well. And again, if I may, with you, Judy Miller, this 18-month prison sentence. I mean, I can imagine this feels like the sort of Damocles, and it must be very difficult for you to be living with. At this point, what is your sense of really what's likely to occur? Do you have any feeling either way?
Well, officially, I remain optimistic that the appellate court, that is, the full appellate court, will see things our way. And in fact, early next week, we are filing for that appellate court afternoon to review the 3-judge panel which ruled against us 3-0. And we're hopeful that they will reconsider the 3-judge panel's view and ruling. And then if we lose there, we're going to take this to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will have us.
Well, at this point, and I wish you good luck and success, obviously, but there is a kind of major job on your part and on those who are sympathetic with you as far as public education and the role of investigative reporters, the importance of them and working for the public and making people realize perhaps that these show laws protect the public interest. However, in light of the Apple case, which we talked about here, and I want to get you on record on this, a lot of people are now looking at First Amendment protections perhaps in a different light. After all, in your case, there was a criminal violation of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, as it was at least rendered in judgment.
Wait, Michael. There's no clear criminal violation that's been stated at this point. There's an investigation, as we understand it, of a possible criminal violation, and there have been a lot of public statements made by people who, for instance, wrote the law, that they're probably isn't a criminal violation here. At least we don't know if there is. And what makes Judy's case in particular and Mr. Cooper's case really interesting, or if you will, somewhat Kafkaesque, is that in the opinions issued by the court and the filings by the prosecutor, the reasons why he wants to talk to them, the reasons why they should identify their sources, are blanked out or redacted. So you have, for the first time in the history of the United States, an appellate decision from this circuit court that has 6 blank pages in it that are all the reasons why they want the information.
Okay, so you can see some of the dilemma that's going on with Miller and them, but what it in part has to do with is that you have Boy George and his administration flexing their muscle and intimidating even those who have been beholden to them, in alignment with them for years. So it has to be looked into the context of the issue concerning what Judy Miller finds herself in with the Empire. Is not some reporter with integrity fighting for true First Amendment rights and is an ambassador for a separation of and a right for reporters to have their confidential sources remain confidential to protect issues like whistleblowers and things like that. She basically is just getting caught up in this snare of an empire that is starting to expand. They, Boy George and them basically are being so belligerent that it's almost to the point where they're not even trying to go through the motions of being somewhat objective when it concerns news reports and media and stuff like that. They're just coming out, making their own news reports, like Arnold, you know, the old dope-head, steroided out Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, and then basically just passing it off as news without even establishing or even going through the pretense of establishing that it's basically a cooked-up doctrine by the government and stuff. This is how cynical these guys have become. And it looks like at this point in time, even some of their long-beholden egos, like Judith Miller, have been caught up in the snare. It's to the point where they want to know every bit of information that even their most reliable hack journalists have, when they get it, who tells them, and at what time they've gotten this information. And if they show the least bit of hesitation, they're willing to slap them around the Pentagon and the New York Times boardroom if need be.
Two things. First, on the question of official propaganda pushing a doctrine, this is becoming a real serious problem. Our listeners should know, Trace, that when a government official does that, they hire well-known news broadcasters who normally work like, let's say, television, and have them read that statement so that from all appearances it looks like news. And they actually make a video and pass these videos around and play them, and it really, unless you knew better, you might think it was news, in fact. A genuine bona fide news story with a genuine bona fide journalist. Now, on the second thing though about Miller, this is icky and ooky, because as you stated correctly, she's a hack, no doubt, with no shame, no doubt. I mean, I don't know what they talked about on Mr. Krasny's program, but I know this. If she was connected with Chalabi, it would seem to me she'd be hiding, trying to stay out the limelight. Because it's embarrassing after it was discovered that Mr. Chalabi was indeed spying for Iran consciously against the United States' so-called interests. So, you know, any friend of Chalabi might not be a friend of Sam on that level. So one would think she'd be too embarrassed to run her mouth. Nevertheless, one has to say it would not be a good thing. We hear you, it would not be a good thing for anybody, including Miss Miller, to actually do jail time under these circumstances with blank indictments and all that old foolishness. This would be a bad thing.
Now, next up, Krasny asked Miller about reporters' subjects to reveal confidential information, should they be subjected, like other entities are, not all entities, but other entities throughout America are. So let's check out their conversation from there.
Decision back in 2003, I don't know if this holds up now, in Chicago Federal Appeals Court, that journalists are subject to subpoenas like any other witnesses?
Well, there have been a variety of different rulings that contradict each other. And that's precisely why I think the Supreme Court needs to revisit Brandsburg from 1972, because you have different rules in different states and different federal districts. In the telephone record case, Mike, that you just talked about earlier, Judge Sweet in New York said, well, you know, Judith Miller is protected from appearing before a grand jury and revealing confidential sources, and your request, Mr. Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney and the special prosecutor, for her telephone records is tantamount to subpoenaing her. And no, you cannot do that in the state of New York. We have a shield law. So in that instance, we were totally vindicated. And the irony for me is that if I were in state court in New York, no one would be able to put me in jail for refusing to discuss confidential sources before a grand jury, because I'm protected in the state of New York. But across the street, if I'm in federal court, I'm not. And we're saying the time has come to kind of clarify this and to recognize that the overwhelming majority of states have now said that, yes, the First Amendment deserves people who carry out the First Amendment, who live it and breathe it and try and bring information to the public, do have a special legal category, just like doctors, lawyers, clergy, psychotherapists, and there should be some protection here. And, you know, this is really, I keep saying, not about me. It's not about Matt Cooper. It's not about the 20 other people across this journalist who have, across the country, who have similar subpoenas. This is about the public's right to know. Are people, are whistleblowers going to continue to come forward to us and give us information that we need to do our jobs? Otherwise, Lowell and I are, you know, we're kind of out of business.
Okay, so you hear Miller once again talk about some of the issues going on, like in state court, she's protected under the whole First Amendment as a reporter, but in the federal court, you're not. See, as I said before, this is, you can see, basically the empire where she has helped gain power. She has helped consolidate their power. Now they are expanding, and basically it appears that they're starting to discipline some of their own reporters. I mean, they've always disciplined their little Fourth Estate of lawyers, reporters, in many ways. These guys are already in the fold, but they're taking away even some of the little historical pretenses that some of the people may or may not have had. Now, what's also fascinating in part about some of this type of stuff is that Miller has blurred the line herself on the whole concept of confidential sources. By the way, that her so-called confidential sources have, from a journalistic standpoint, have been so pathetic that it's really hard to call them truly confidential sources, and not just a pure manipulation of the facts and details at hand to push through a particular agenda. Now, it came out when the New York Times was, and others were talking about doing another confidential, or shall I say, a report with Chalabi. Judith Miller wanted to have more access to Chalabi. And what ended up happening was she was in a conversation through email with some of the people who were involved in this. And she stated outrightly how Chalabi had been a very important resource for a lot of her information concerning the weapons of mass destruction. Now, there were times when she outwardly said this in her particular articles that I'll get to a little bit later, but there were other times where she was just mentioning sources and you wouldn't know what was what. It was just these so-called sources that she was supposed to have had. So this is how Miller was playing a lot of this type of stuff. But they'll get into this. But first, let's move on and deal with Krasny next asking Lowell and Miller about how the rights of reporters to gather governmental information is being challenged by the state. So let's see where they go from there. Check this out.
It seems, Lowell, as if this has a lot to do with the obtaining of information. I mean, that's what's being challenged in so many of these cases, as opposed to a libel action, which is much more difficult to win, or what you could call the final journalistic product.
It is about information and gathering and reporting. And in fact, it has this strange sense to me of what I went through in the tobacco situation at CBS, where the general counsel at CBS used the argument that this was potentially tortious interference, another complex concept. But basically, it came down to, we weren't allowed to gather this information. wasn't publishing it, gather the information, because it was protected by a confidentiality agreement. Similarly here, we are seeing a challenge to our ability to gather, in this case, government information, and protect the source if it violates a law or a confidentiality agreement, even if that information is in the public interest. And that's being challenged by this administration, I think, in the general policies about giving out information to the press, in dealing with the press, in the president's recent statement yesterday in a press conference where he endorsed his use of his own video releases being put on television unlabeled, presented as news information. So we're seeing, I think, a fundamental argument here over what's the role of the press, what is our ability to gather information and provide it to the public.
And plus, if I can just interject here, in addition to that, there's the growing secrecy within the U.S. government in general that has come about as a result of 9/11, so that it's increasingly hard to get information that used to be publicly available on websites from government agencies or government records. All of these are now either classified secret or they're marked sensitive, but they're not distributed. So we are increasingly dependent on the courage of individuals who come forth and say, look, really ought to know what's going on here. It's not what the public affairs spokesman at the Department of Defense is telling you.
Okay, so you see Miller and them complaining about what the state is doing, and it's no doubt that they are expanding and they're basically disciplining the reporters at hand, telling them we want to know everything, when you get it, how you get it, etc. So when you see Lowell talk about we see this as a challenge to us gathering government information. Well, the reason why one should look at them cynically is because they've helped empower the government in its secrecy and in its arts of deception in the first place. So now you have a situation where the lines have been completely blurred between state propaganda, the fourth estate role of the media, the role of so-called journalists like Miller, and how they come out with their particular headlines and so on and so forth. So like on December 20th, 2001, one of Miller's headlines for the New York Times read, quote, "Iraqis tell of renovations at site for chemical and nuclear arms." Now, Iraqi, what Iraqi? You know, so then it's all blurred with these particular types of phraseologies and stuff. Then she ends up being in bed with, in a sense, this one cat named Hamza. It's Qadir Hazma. She outlines that he's a new Iraqi defector. And he was supposed to be a Saddam's bomb maker. This turned out to be a complete fraud. This Hamza was, you know, not some bomb maker. But this is how some of her story read on this subject matter. Quote, "An Iraqi defector who described himself as a civil engineer said he personally worked on renovations of secret facilities for biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons in underground wells, private villas, and under the Saddam Hussein Hospital in Baghdad as recently as a year ago. The defector, Adan Ishan Saeed al-Hadiri, gave details of the project he said he worked on for President Saddam Hussein's government in an extensive interview last week in Bangkok. The interview with Mr. Saeed was arranged by the Iraqi National Congress." We know who, this is me cutting, we know who's a part of the Iraqi National Congress. Shalabi. To go on, the main Iraqi opposition group, which seeks the overthrow of Mr. Hussein. If verified, Mr. Saeed's allegations would provide ammunition to officials within the Bush administration who have been arguing that Mr. Hussein should be driven from power, partly because of his unwillingness to stop making weapons of mass destruction. Now, unquote. She talks about if verified, it was never verified, but the propaganda within these like headlining pieces basically do what they're designed to do. A September 7th, 2002 headline by Miller says, quote, U.S. says Hussein intensifies quest for A-bomb parts, unquote. So once again, this was another aspect of what they were pushing out. This time it was the aluminum tube propaganda. So Miller and another writer named Gordon, Michael Gordon, pushed out this whole aluminum tube. Now, this thing was also discredited, but you remember how far that aluminum tube story went and how it was used over and over by the Pentagon as something that was had credence. Now, Miller comes across another defector. Now, this is what this particular defector was supposed to have said. Quote, speaking on the condition that neither he nor the country in which he was interviewed be identified, Ami al-Shamiri, his pseudonym, said Iraq had continued developing, producing, and storing chemical agents at many mobile and fixed secret sites throughout the country, many of them underground. Now look, she says that this guy, Amit al-Shamiri, this is his pseudonym, so it's not his real name, he's speaking on the condition that neither he nor the country in which he was interviewed be identified. So you don't know who he is. You can't verify who this guy is. You can't verify the country that he's speaking from. But you get from Judy Miller that this guy, who we don't know who he is, where he's from, what country he's speaking from, said Iraq had continued developing, producing, and storing chemical agents at many mobile and fixed secret sites throughout the country, many of them underground. So you can see how the New York Times under Judy Miller are pushing out these types of claims that can't be verified by anyone. She's not going to try to verify them because she doesn't have to. It's just a propaganda move by her that anyone who wants to challenge on her on it or just try to verify some of the information has no way of doing it because it's locked within her own, basically, imagination. So this is how Miller has played her particular role in helping the empire increase its secrecy, its deception, its misdirection on the public. She was doing it herself in part. Now, the fact that there are the state is now flexing itself in a sense to expand itself even more and wanting to bring even these beholden reporters under their wing even more so is not a situation where she's really being victimized. Basically, she has helped create a situation where the empire has been able to produce these wars under the illusion that people like her have fostered. But next, let's go into how Krasny asked Miller's use of confidential sources that have been discredited and how they have helped bolster, more or less, Boy George administration's expansion policies. So let's see how Miller deals with this. Check this out.
Since you mentioned that, of course, it would be remiss of me if I didn't ask you about the kind of heat that you've come under with a whole different kind of rubric, and that is accepting information or relying on information from dissidents and from discredited sources with respect to the lead-up to the Iraq War and the weapons of mass destruction. I mean, I'm sure you've seen a lot of these articles. They downright accuse you of channeling the administration's case on WMDs and inflating and presenting information in a deceptive way, but it brings up a greater question. I want you, of course, to defend yourself, but it brings up a greater question. That is, even when you have the confidential sources, the investigation and analysis of the intelligence and how to know whether it's credible intelligence is maybe even a more difficult question in these vexing times, isn't it?
Well, let me just say before Judy jumps in that it's always possible that confidential source relationships can be abused, that you can be manipulated. I think it's a question of how the publication or how the person who receives that information, and if they're, let's say, part of the New York Times, how their editors deal with that information. I would say that in almost every case that I've looked at and articles that I've read related to what Judy was up to and what she was reporting, not only went through the system at the New York Times, so obviously it had some checks and balances, and there were people that are very aware of what she was doing and where she was getting it, but the information, in fact, was labeled as coming from an administration source, or coming from someone like Ahmed Chalabi, who I also am familiar with, who was a man who obviously wants to overthrow the government of Iraq at that time, Saddam. And so the reader and the audience knew where the information was coming from. I don't think that anyone would have said that Judy had done anything that was inappropriate if, in fact, weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq. And furthermore, I think everyone now understands that every administration before this administration, including this administration, and most of the experts believe there were weapons of mass destruction, and that's what she was reporting.
Yeah, there was wrong intelligence all across Europe.
Well, that's what they're saying.
Understood.
You know, right? I mean, but, so you can't to blame the war on Iraq on Judy and Ahmed Chalabi. My own opinion is to give them a lot more power, if you will, than they had.
But
okay, so you can see how cynical this whole process is. Because when they fall back and talk about how there was this wrong intelligence and everyone got it wrong because the intelligence community got it wrong, this, of course, wants you to slide past the fact that people like Rumsfeld set up artificial intelligence agencies like the Office of Special Plans to counter information that was coming from the CIA or whoever else that didn't fit his liking. Now, you didn't see Judy Miller challenge the formation of these types of covert, obviously, secretive at times, disinformation program / intel setups that were happening within the administration. Instead, they were going goose-stepping right along with what the administration was doing. As a matter of fact, you had a situation like when the actual war actually started, there was what was called the MET, the Mobile Exploration Team. And what ended up happening was this team was out to look for the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq once, the U.S. boots got into Iraq, once they started their war, so on and so forth. After a certain amount of time, they realized that there were no weapons of mass destruction there. I'm talking about the MET team. So Miller wrote a letter objecting to an army commander who was starting to withdraw from the field, and said that if they did continue their search, that she would go directly to Donald Rumsfeld and threatened him basically of this doing. So they went on with the whole farce, that they continued to look and so on and so forth. But what I'm saying is that here you have someone undermining any form of objectivity for her own personal incentives as a so-called journalist. And this fit right into what the administration was doing, which was the whole art of deception. See, remember back during that time, boy George and them were, they kept saying, give us time. It's a big country. We haven't looked over everything yet. There's still time. We still may find stuff. We're coming up with new reports at all the time. It became obvious that they were just buying time. And after a certain amount of time, they were just kind of shape-shifted into something else. Now, the trick is often to say that Saddam intentionally misled everyone. And he wanted everyone to believe he had weapons of mass destruction. And they unwittingly believed it. I mean, this is how sick and cynical. But you heard Lowell make up all of these excuses and say that, look, you know, a lot of her reports went through the New York Times and there's checks and balances. And these went through administration sources. Well, I just mentioned the Office of Special Plans. And these so-called checks and balances, remember, when one of the administration officials admitted that when they were trying to dupe the American public into going into Iraq, it was hard to get the population motivated on the invasion. So what they had decided to do was to make the claim that there would be a mushroom cloud in America if they did not go in and take care of Saddam. And they realized by pressing that scare tactic button that that was the one thing that was starting to resonate amongst the American population. So this exposes how this was an intentional manipulation from the highest levels within the administration. And those like Judy Miller just played right along with it from their Fourth Estate aspect to terrorize the population and help the Gumpification process down by doing everything that was an alternative from true independent journalism. So like Miller and Gordon wrote in another article concerning germ warfare and the existence of it in Iraq. This is what they had to say, quote, "Iraq denied the existence of germ warfare program entirely until 1995, when United Nations inspectors forced Baghdad to acknowledge it had such an effort. Then, after insisting that it had never weaponized bacteria or field warheads, it again belatedly acknowledged having done so after Hussein Kamel, Mr. Hussein's brother-in-law, defected to Jordan with evidence about the scale of the germ warfare program," unquote. Now, what's sinister about this is that what Miller and them left out was that Hussein Kamel also told the UN inspectors that he had personally destroyed all of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction on Saddam Hussein's order. Now, if you think back, during that time, the administration was also pushing that whole line about Hussein Kamel's comments. Boy George and them were repeating it, and they were intentionally leaving out the fact that the same Hussein Kamel had admitted that the weapons of mass destructions were destroyed by himself, that he had overseen it, and it was at the orders of Saddam Hussein. So by leaving this important fact out, they, of course, were perpetuating the illusion that there was still something going on. See, so when they talk about government sources and those sources that were verified by the government, well, if you're not given the whole total picture intentionally, you can't just call that sloppy journalism. This is intentional manipulation by the likes of Judy Miller with an agenda at hand that was right in alignment with Boy George's administration. Now next, Miller checks in on the subject matter of her sources. So let's see what she has to say. Check this out.
Big question here, Judy, I'm sure you recognize, about how you check your sources and being manipulated through misinformation and so forth. I mean, it can be done all the time.
Of course it can, and we're always, we are only as good as our sources, and we're only as good as our effort to vet our sources. And, is my reporting, is any of our reporting perfect? Of course not. Do we make mistakes? Of course we do. But on balance, if you look back at those stories, you will see all of the caveats about the sources. You will see outsiders commenting and evaluating the information or attempting to. You will see a lot of qualifiers about the information. And, the fact of the matter is, if the sources are wrong upon whom you're basing your story, the story's going to be wrong. And we're not soothsayers. We're only as good as our sources, which, by the way, for me, illustrates exactly why good sources are so critical to what we do. You know, I heard after I was actually embedded in a military unit in Iraq for 5 months, so I kind of didn't, I came to this debate late, learning of it late myself from the field, but when I came back and heard all of these people saying, oh, there were all of these people who doubted, well, I would have loved to have heard from them before the war, but we didn't. And for whatever reason, people who allegedly or supposedly had doubts really didn't come forward. And what I'm saying now with this case is, we have to make it easier for such people to come forward. We can't make it riskier for them. We can't make them feel that if they come to Lowell or me with sensitive information, that we're not going to protect them, that we're going to expose them, reveal their identities, compromise them, and they're going to lose their jobs. All the things that people fear, and I think, especially in any administration that's trying to keep secrets. So I think, I'm the same person. I'm the same reporter. I have the same attitude towards the source protection and evaluation of sources that I had before and after. To me, what this case has done is emphasize how critical it is that we do everything possible in this country to encourage whistleblowers. That, I'm just as good as my material. I can't be better.
Yes, so you've heard it for yourself. Put two and two together. She's just as good as Chalabi. Can't be better.
Okay, when Miller goes into, her sources and Chalabi and all of that, like I was saying before, when, Chalabi was this little convicted embezzler, his little Iraqi National Congress was basically a U.S. finance exile group that made close ties with the administration. So they're locked. Chalabi has been locked in with a similar agenda as Boy George and them. Concerning this whole thing with Iran, remember back when things stopped going well for Boy George and the U.S. Empire in Iraq, it became clear that this wasn't going to be a particular cakewalk through Iraq. And Chalabi had been an outward proponent of the new government. And it was obvious that he was in lockstep at the time with the Bush administration. Then all of a sudden, Chalabi negative reports started to come out about Chalabi by basically the Fourth Estate, by the corporate media, that was basically portraying Chalabi as someone who had misled the U.S. and was working with Iran. But if you fast forward it, all of a sudden, Chalabi ended up being one of the candidates for election in the recent election scam in Iraq. So one has to put into consideration that they may have never really fallen out with Chalabi. That whole thing of putting, saying that he was working with Iran and that they were looking for him to arrest them and all of that type of stuff may have been just a setup to put some distance between them and Chalabi, who they never really had a fallen out with, but to make it appear so that he could maintain some credibility on his comeback trail since things the first time along did not go as smooth as the U.S. Empire had thought that it was going to when they first stomped into Iraq. But to go on, in an interview, she had forged a number of relationships, close relationships. But in one time, she had noted that he, Chalabi, had provided most of the front page exclusives on weapons of mass destruction in our paper. Now, what's interesting about this is that Miller never cited Chalabi in her weapons of mass destruction exclusives. She would cite, as I mentioned earlier, unnamed sources or people under pseudonyms and all of that type of stuff. But Chalabi, you know, Chalabi was over here. So she would cite Chalabi on other little types of, you know, so-called misinformation issues. So when this was revealed, it helped expose the fact that this was all just a little setup with her and Chalabi as being some kind of a source for her. But, you know, to move on some of the other information that is clear that she's been manipulative on, when she talks about you're only as good as your sources and things like that, she has stated that the U.S. military had discovered two, quote, mobile biowarfare labs, unquote. Now, Boy George then cited this was proof of Iraqis' weapons of mass destruction, and that the scientific community and large sections of the U.S. and British intelligence later concluded that this whole charge was false. In other words, here you have Miller coming out with these claims of what the military was supposed to have found prior to the war, that they had somehow came across these things. Boy George running out, announcing this type of stuff. And after all, if someone has mobile biowarfare labs, what would they have them for unless they have a program going on and are actually trying to get into the actual production in violation of, you know, the particular agreements that Saddam was supposed to be under. Now, all of this stuff was later discredited, but see, Miller had done her job. And once again, often these so-called sources couldn't be verified. Now, another one of her exclusives, and this was followed by a headline, was, quote, U.S. experts find radioactive material in Iraq, and that U.S.-led forces occupy Baghdad's complex filled with chemical agents, unquote. Once again, these were unfounded. But see, they were doing their job. They were giving the illusion when she was making these statements that radioactive material, a complex filled with chemical agents. Look, that could have been Lysol as far as we know. But but this is what she was intentionally doing, because it was all about disinformation. This is how she operates. Now, it should be noted that Miller has deep connections in right-wing and pro-Zionist think tanks. This includes the American Enterprise Institute, the Hudson Institute, the Washington Institute for Near East Policies, and the Mideast Forum. Now, at one time, she was listed as an expert for the Mideast Forum. So we should put these things into a certain amount of perspective when we consider someone like her. and how she's basically a PR specialist slash lobbyist for imperial think tanks and for the Pentagon itself. Now, what's also interesting is that the Mideast Forum, which is led by Daniel Pipes, has not only advocated war for against Iraq, but has also urged U.S. invasions of Syria and Lebanon, and stated that its goals to maintain strong ties with the U.S. and, of course, Israel. And the necessity to do this was, amongst other things, to help stabilize a supply, to maintain a stable supply and cheap price of oil. Now, of course, this is just rhetoric, because you can look at what's going on now, and you could tell, historically, whatever land the capitalists conquer or try to conquer, that's not going to, quote unquote, fall back into your little gas tanks. This is how imperialism plays into another line of misinformation. But this is the true Julie Miller, and the type of program that she has been a part of for years. So when you hear her talk about you're only as good as your sources, and her as a journalist, she picked those sources. It's her journalistic obligation to pick sources and to evaluate the sources and to check into sources in the background of the sources and to see if some of her sources is are being validated by some of the things that they're saying. She went through long periods with Chalabi and others where their so-called accusations were proving to be to disintegrate in the air. But she never backed up off of those sources. Now next, Krasny asked Miller about has the Jason Blair episode affected the New York Times? Jason Blair is a little Negro who was intentionally miswriting about a lot of sources and making up stories and so on and so forth. And this became an embarrassment to the New York Times. Not to Judy Miller, but the Jason Blair. So let's check out what both of them had to say.
Mo alluded before to the checks and balances of the New York Times, and of course the public perception since Jason Blair has been very, in many ways, uncertain, demoralizing. Has that affected your work, or how has that affected you?
Well, it hasn't really affected my work, because once this began, this litigation, and it began in secret, I mean, people suddenly started noticing that I was not in the paper very much. Well, I was beginning to fight, prepare a legal fight, and then it hadn't been made public on the subpoena. And it's been kind of hard for me to do investigative journalism. I've been doing oil for food, the United Nations oil for food scandal. I've been writing a little bioterrorism, but by and large, Michael, something like this totally totally consumes you, which is another aspect of this that I don't think, you know, the public understands. That you can get put out of business just by being sued. It's so time consuming. But I don't think, you know, I think the New York Times had a very bad year with Jason Blair. We had a regime change at the top, our own regime change, and that's always unsettling, and things take time to kind of sort out and settle out. But I have to say that when I look at the newspaper and its commitment to news and its extraordinary commitment to fight the government on issues like this, I'm proud every day that I work for the paper, and I think the amount and quality of the work that it does is just extraordinary, and I would be much poorer as a nation if that paper did not exist.
Okay, so basically she's just basically an unrepentant propagandist for the ruling class, which is what one should expect. As a matter of fact, the New York Times has been always consistently defending Miller, even after many of the things have been discredited and exposed. they have come out and said, quote, "We think she did really good work there," unquote. This was the Times assistant managing editor, Andrew Rosenthal. Rosenthal said also, quote, "We think she broke some important stories," unquote. And he dismissed charges made by, you know, a number of military officers about how she conducted herself when she was embedded with the MET, as I mentioned before, saying that she was going to tell Rumsfeld on them if they did not continue their search for weapons of mass destruction on the ground, when they had already come to the conclusion that basically it was a lost cause. Now, Judy Miller has deep links to the Pentagon historically. In 86, she wrote a number of articles on Libya and put out a number of disinformation campaigns on Gaddafi. And it was, and she coordinated these things with Admiral Poindexter at the time. You could check out Bob Woodward's work. And he wrote many things about how this whole strategy had played. This is something that Miller has long been embedded with, disinformation programs. And one should put it in the context that the New York Times has not had a problem with it. She's considered a talented reporter. This is someone who has based a large part of her career on misinformation campaigns and the art of deception. So when she talks about the Jason Blair issue making a hit on the New York Times, the paper of record, one should put into a context the role that she has played and the damage it has done on a global level, not just on some little, you know, local level, some guy just writing some smack about whatever issue he decided to write about. But this is someone tied within the highest levels of the administration. Now, next, Krasny reads some of the emails he got from listeners concerning Judy Miller's treachery. And let's see how they respond. Check it out.
Just a moment. Judy Miller, as you might imagine, I'm getting blitzed with emails here about your role in the reporting leading up to the Iraq War. And let me just give you a sampling. Some of them, frankly, are pretty harsh. Judy Miller should go to jail, says one, but not for the charges she's up on. In addition to her pieces in the New York Times, her appearances on the PBS NewsHour were clearly propaganda designed to sell the invasion of Iraq. It's hard to believe she didn't know she was spreading false information. This comes from another listener named Lloyd, who says former head of UNSCOM, Scott Ritter, was widely known to dispute the government's claims regarding WMDs in Iraq. Another listener, Ron, says she's still spouting this misleading information. There were plenty of informed people. What about Hans Blix? And so it goes. I mean, it's tough to answer these charges, but you've heard of them before.
Yeah. What I think I want to just say a couple of things and then keep this focused on the issue at hand. Scott Ritter is one of the people who got money now from the government of Iraq. This is now established through a cutout, a man who is now under investigation in this country. The documentary that he made defending Saddam Hussein was financed with diverted oil for food money. Mr. Ritter was a maverick even within UNSCOM. I quoted UNSCOM inspectors in my articles by name. They put their names to what they were saying. As for Hans Blix, you're right. You read about him in the New York Times, a Judy Miller interview before the war, saying that even though he believed that Saddam Hussein was still hiding weapons of mass destruction, you can go back and look at the piece, that he didn't think that the that those violations constituted sufficient grounds to go to war, and that's what Mr. Blix argues in his book, that he thought there were weapons of mass destruction in New York. In Iraq. That is one of the... there are probably also weapons of mass destruction in New York, but that's... You know, you go with what you've got at the moment. You try and vet it. You try and get other opinions. You try and get people on the record. And then you just go on reporting. Journalism is just a first cut at history, and the answer to insufficient or inaccurate reporting is more reporting, and to go on doing that, and that's what we've tried to do. But these constant attacks on the media, on me, on everybody else, I mean, you know, no wonder prosecutors can think it's really okay to have open season on the press and our sources, that it's okay to go after the people who leak information to me or to Lowell Bergman. I'm not sure today. In fact, I'm sure that the book I wrote on bioterrorism called Germs could not have been written in the current climate with the attitude towards the media, with the growing secrecy of government information. And that book did a lot to kind of awaken people, I think, to the threat of bioterrorism. And I don't know whether or not a Jeff Feigen would have come forward today given the climate. I think we're certainly journalists are not saints, but try running a functioning democracy without us. It would be really, really hard, and we're not perfect. I've never claimed to be, but I certainly have a very few qualms about the material I wrote before, because I think it reflected what people widely believed, the fact that that turned out to be wrong.
Would it be unfair?
Intelligence was wrong, by the way, is it should be a great source of concern to people.
I agree.
Because then what do we know about everything else?
Exactly. And
okay, once again, this helps expose how cynical this process is. Because, you know, when you have Judy Miller talking about you have to just go with what you got at the time that you have it, this is, in essence, a form of hit-and-run journalism. And what they do is they set up a gumpified system where it's known as the... front page syndrome, and I also call it the headline syndrome, where you make these loud accusations within your headline by whatever sources, and this helps set the tone and put into the public's mind something much more unnuanced than it really is. So when you have someone like Judy Miller making these dynamic front page or in headline articles and statements that give the impression that bombs are going to be falling the next night in your backyard, then of course you could see how this type of hit-and-run journalism and front-page propaganda or headline journalism takes its effect, because they're doing two things. They're, one, using these types of fake sources to make wild accusations. But they do the hit and run because they've moved on to something else, and they're the very next day they're making other wild claims and accusations. And at a certain point in time, the public at large is getting bombarded by all of these particular claims and overwhelmed by all of these claims. But they're moving at 1,000 miles an hour, and they're not really defining or doing any kind of in-depth back-checking on the so-called sources that they're getting a number of their information from. So when it became clear that the New York Times had basically cheerleaded the U.S. Population into this imperial war with the ruling class masters, the Times came out and the editors said, quote, "We have found a number of instances of coverage that was not as rigorous as it should have been. They had it displayed on their website, a list of some of their worst examples of these journalistic, shenanigans. Miller's byline was on a number of them, but they still defend her. And by defending her, this gives an insight that at the end of the day, this is not just an individual thing. This is those who are in alignment with the empire will be rewarded. Those who serve a purpose will be tolerated. So in the same way that you'll be seeing that Negro Armstrong Williams, who got caught with all the money shoved up his rectum and the American flag, try to make his comeback. And somehow you'll see him within the corporate media circles still maintain a certain amount of quote-unquote credibility. This is how Judith Miller is still able to walk around and act like she has credibility as a journalist. Because it's not so much of the fact that her sources and her journalistic reporting have fell way beneath standards of any kind of true journalistic standards, but her commitment to back the ruling elite's objectives has been something that she has done diligently, and from that point she maintains her credibility.
And from that point she'll be forgiven again and again and again. Although I thought they were gonna lock up for real though about that Chalabi stuff. That was so scandalous. You know what? Now Tracy made a statement earlier that got me to thinking. What if they just cooked up all that Iran stuff to create distance between the United States and Chalabi to help Chalabi? Well, stop and think about this case right here. Are they going to lock this woman up? We will know. If indeed she does not go to jail, and you know it's 99 to 100 that you're going to go to jail when you go to appellate court, because you got to have a powerful case to turn an appellate, situation around, an appeal around, et cetera, et cetera. It's not the norm that they just override appellate judges. In fact, lately, this has been the whole deal. That's why Crime Bill Clinton had the Accelerated Death Penalty Act. I forget the actual name of it, but part of that was you could not challenge the findings of fact of a state judge. Okay? I'm doubtful this woman's going to go to jail. And if she doesn't go to jail, then you have to think, why did they charge her? It's not like they have no impact, no power over the system that they operate. Why would they charge her at all? Unless they were trying to shore up some severely damaged credentials. Whereas the New York Times themselves, I saw that article too, admit that their reportage was no good. Just a thought.
And as I said about, some of the hit-and-run headlines, scare tactic headlines, misinformation, when you see her talk about how she names sources or how she gets particular sources, December 3rd, 2002, Miller had a headline article saying, quote, CIA hunts Iraq's tie to Soviet smallpox, unquote. So that was her headline. And then she goes on in the article saying that, quote, the CIA is investigating an informant's accusation that Iraq obtained a particularly virulent strain of smallpox from a Russian scientist who worked in a smallpox lab in Moscow during Soviet times. So here you have her talking about, this is no way you could verify it. First she's saying the CIA is investigating an informant's accusation. We don't know who this informant is. It's the CIA that's investigating. And this is the accusation that Iraq obtained a particular virulent strain of smallpox from a Russian scientist. What Russian scientist? So now it's an informant accusation that the CIA is investigating that Iraq obtained a particular strain of smallpox from a Russian scientist who worked in a smallpox lab in Moscow during the Soviet time. We're in Russian time. So you can see how convoluted this whole thing is. There's no way of verifying any of this.
They did verify that. You know what that was? In that particular case, it winds up that there was a collaboration to fight smallpox. And that particular Russian, because what happened was that Russian doctor came forward and said, listen, I don't want y'all scandalizing my name. I ain't had nothing to do with no biotech, nothing. They were fighting smallpox in Iraq. That's how out of crazy this stuff is. That recently came out. The guy reclaimed his name.
Well, see, the thing that had she, as she wrote it, was...
some kind of Dr. Mengele trying to kill up somebody. He was fighting Paul Smallpox.
The way she wrote it is that the CIA is investigating an informant's accusation that Iraq obtained a particularly virulent strain of smallpox. So, this Russian scientist that may have come forward or whatever, we don't know how... or if this is even the same stuff that
she, real.
Yeah, that she's trying to convolute in this whole CIA. She's given this whole image. The CIA's investigating something. It's an informant's accusation about what Iraq is doing. See, this is the same type of propaganda that they were trying to put out about the African-Niger-Iraq connection about the uranium. But it got blown out by the ambassador or former ambassador, and that's what really pissed them off when he came forward and said, nah, there's nothing to that. Miller, who also was attacking at the time UN inspectors, and what she said about the UN inspectors, because, you know, the UN inspectors, if you check, they basically were saying, look, like Scott Ritter, there's no way he has anything. The biological stuff, the chemical stuff, it doesn't have a shelf life that long in the first place. The nuclear stuff we've long taken care of, it's discredited. He doesn't have this stuff. But what Miller was doing at the time, like... in the January 24, 2003 headline articles, quote, defectors boister U.S. case against Iraq, officials say, unquote. So she goes into former Iraqi scientists, what scientists, we don't know, of course, military officers and contractors have provided American intelligence agencies with a portrait of Saddam Hussein's secret programs to develop and conceal chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons that is starkly at odds with the findings so far of the United Nations weapons inspectors, unquote. Now, the reason why I mention this is you just heard her say that everyone thought he still had it. But see, going back to January 24th, she's talking about these Iraqi scientists, military officers, and contractors are providing American intelligence agencies something that's contradicting what the United Nations weapons inspectors were saying. So obviously the United Nations weapons inspectors, which they were saying, was that he doesn't have anything. But now on the radio, she's trying to portray it like we were all in bamboozled by Saddam. We all thought he did have it. This shows you how she's trying to manipulate as time goes on. And her true role back in the day of manipulating this whole question at hand. Now, next, Krasny asks, that she feels that the administration's sources were bamboozled by Chalabi. So let's see what they have to say. Check it out.
Would you agree with perhaps administration sources conceding that they got conned by Chalabi, that you got conned by Chalabi?
No, they've never conceded that. They have, people have asserted that. But in fact, the assertion, what the president was told when he was asked about the quality of the intelligence underlying his assertion that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, was from the CIA, the director of the CIA, George Kennedy, said, "Don't worry, Mr. President, it's a slam dunk." Well, if the president is being told there is no doubt absolutely that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, I don't find it surprising that I was being told the same thing or that either one of us believed it.
So she, there it is. So now she's basically covering for Boy George. If the president is being told by the CIA, who's playing the role of the fall guy, then it shouldn't be a surprise that basically we're all bamboozled, you know, us in the journalistic field, so on and so forth.
But we are the weapons of mass destruction, and that's too concrete to get around that.
And also you have a situation where, as a journalist, she was the one who was helping provide the so-called sources to help bolster the claim. So wouldn't it be upon her journalistic duty to look into who the CIA was bringing up, who the Office of Special Plans were bringing up as their sources, see if she can investigate and clarify and verify what these people were doing and saying? No. Of course not, because she was right along with that whole process of distortion. She wasn't trying to verify anything. She was doing her hit-and-run tactics, her propagandistic tactics, and attacking the UN and other sources without hesitation. You didn't see her, of course, challenge Rumsfeld and all of these other clowns who were coming up with their own particular intelligence agencies to actually counter the CIA's findings if and when it wasn't in cahoots with her, with their liking. So for her to pretend that she has no regret and all of that about the whole Chalabi episode basically exposes how complicit she is in this whole process of disinformation. Now, last to show how quacked out this population is, here's David, a caller, who comes to Judy's defense on this whole issue. Check this out.
Oh, next to David. Morning, David.
Good morning. I think only in San Francisco would I have to jump to the defense of Judy and, on the Iraq situation. But, you know, too many people in San Francisco have taken Michael Moore hook, line, and sinker and think all of this is lies and deception and so on. Every major intelligence service in the world thought the same thing. Judy Miller reported it very accurately. And Saddam Hussein had a very good intent to deceive the world because he felt that if he didn't show that he had weapons of mass destruction and a strong military, he would be overthrown, either internally or perhaps by Iran. So the whole idea of a conspiracy theory that the whole world was lied to by, I don't know who, President Bush, is nonsense. And so, Judy, I defend you. I think you have a lot of integrity. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. I'm sure that's music to your ears. Huh?
Well, one person bothered to read the 50.
So that just about says it all. What, when you have some clown basically, you know, pulling out the Michael Moore card and pretending that people who are challenging Miller and what she has been complicit in as being conspiracy theorists, then it's clear that you have people with their own particular agenda and they're not interested in any way themselves being objective, but basically this being part of a disinformation program that serves a particular agenda that is in complete contradiction to what we're trying to achieve and lay out. Hold on a sec.
How about that for realism?
Well, it's interesting if you're a criminologist to watch the Times make its baby steps towards apologizing, because what you have here is an institution that was so corrupted in the 6 weeks, 5 weeks before the Senate, before the Congress voted on the so-called war authorization, that it's very hard to understand now what happened. It's hard for people to go back, because they're seeing these stories admitting they made mistakes, that maybe they exaggerated and so on, too, and they're buried on page 10. It's big news in the media world, but people don't remember the extent to which the Times made itself useful as a propaganda tool for the administration. And they don't realize the extent to which Judith Miller and Michael Gordon volunteered to hype the atomic bomb weapons stories. We know that Scott Ritter and one of his fellow former unsconced inspectors, David Albright, were available for interviews to contradict, for example, the aluminum tubes canard, the story that Saddam trying to acquire aluminum tubes or the Iraqis trying to acquire aluminum tubes was prima facie evidence of a revived atomic bomb project. But people don't realize that Judith Miller was busy all day, all night long, trying to get Saddam Hussein overthrown, and that the United States government was using her through the front page of the New York Times to promote this end. Now, until you get to the bottom of Judith Miller's ill-starred career and you understand the extent to which she's a propagandist and not a journalist, and that the extent to which the Times, through its institutional weight behind a propaganda campaign, you just can't possibly get to the bottom of their malfeasance. Now, if the Times had run a story saying one of those old man in the news stories about Scott Ritter, except we call it man out of the news, a profile of a man who got it right, then you'd see a newspaper that was really apologizing for what it did, because it was absolutely critical to the campaign to drive us into war. Now, what they would do is they would leak the story, and you don't need Chalabi for this. Chalabi was just a secondary confirmation for Judith Miller. They get the feed directly from Cheney's office or from Rumsfeld's office on aluminum tubes or whatever. And the next day, the story appears on the front page of the Times, and then Cheney, Rumsfeld, et al. Hit the airwaves, citing the New York Times story as confirmation of Saddam's revived atomic bomb threat. This is systematic cooperation or collaboration with the government. It's not just, oh, we got it wrong, oh, we were misled. And one other point to make is that the tone, you got to read into the tone of the editor's note in the Times and understand that the Times doesn't see itself really as a newspaper. They see themselves as a kind of adjunct to the government. A normal newspaper would say, yeah, we got it wrong, we apologize to our readers. You wouldn't get this tortured language, which in effect says, we were misled along with the government. We were misled. Our official sources misled us. It's not our fault, really, because after all, we listen to official sources in good faith. We're not journalists. And if you're not really a newspaper, you just take the feed from the government as though you were the government's press agency. Now, one thing to, if you're really interested in this subject, you can read Hal Raines' letter on the Poynter Institute website, responding to the editor's note and pointing out that he was not consulted on the editor's note before it ran.
Yeah.
It's interesting, and this is in the category of the thieves falling out among themselves. Raines makes sure everybody who reads that letter on the Poynter website knows, and he's getting even here, the names of the editors who were responsible for some of Judith Miller's reporting. Jill Abramson, who's now the managing editor of the paper, and he points out that Bill Keller and Stephen Engelberg previously had been responsible for a lot of her reporting and editing. And this is Raines just trying to cover himself and say, I'm not the only one who participated in this debacle. There, the other people are still, two of them are still at the paper. In fact, they're running the paper. Now, where's Judith Miller? Why aren't we hearing from Judith Miller? Why hasn't she been fired? Why hasn't she resigned? It's because the Times as an institution supported the propaganda campaign that drove us into war. For there to be justice in this, you'd have to have resignations from the top down. You'd have to have the publisher, Sulzberger, resign. And to some extent, they're right in not blaming it all on Judith Miller. I mean, in a perverse way, they're showing a little bit of integrity and not just piling on her and saying, we're going to cut her adrift. Because this is an institutional, this is institutional culpability. It's not just one reporter. They encouraged her. They let her run wild. They fomented the whole business through her.
I was called on occasion by people at the New York Times, not during the critical build-up to the war. There was a period of time, I would say, from the summer of 2002 through the invasion in the spring of 2003, where I was pretty much persona non grata with the New York Times and the Washington Post. When I did talk to reporters, they let it be known that my name was not even supposed to be published in the New York Times. The one time the New York Times did make an effort to publish my name was when they hired Barry Barak to write a profile of me in the New York Times magazine, which I think will go down as quite an embarrassment for Mr. Barak, not for me. I don't have anything to do with that story. It's his own fiction. But they weren't seeking the truth. I know Judith Miller. Prior to this time, we would talk often. I would do my best to set her straight on her stories. She would listen, take notes, and then nothing I would say would appear in her pieces. And then during the time of my blackout, there were no phone calls. She contacted me after the war, again trying to prove her point that there were weapons of mass destruction. I would set her straight on the mobile biological labs and other points that she was raising, and nothing I said would appear in the paper. Judith Miller, I agree with Mr. MacArthur, has an agenda. It's one that is not centered on the truth. It's centered on promoting Judy Miller and her biases. And unfortunately for her and the New York Times and the American people, truth is caught up. We're quoting, Judy Miller was running stories from this engineer, Haideri, who was provided by Chalabi. And I was able to provide five or six points where I directly contradicted him and said, if I can contradict him just on the surface of what he's saying, you can't run with the substance of the rest of that material. This is a man who is not believable. His data doesn't stack up technically. His data doesn't stack up logically. His data doesn't stack up, you know, on any of the tests that one would use. There's no independent confirmation of anything this man is saying. Why are you running with it on the front page of your newspaper?
Well, they're running it on the front pages of their newspaper because they can, and they'll continue to until they exist no more. They don't serve our purpose. They're there for the purpose of putting us in a gumpified lockdown cell. A cell we must break out and remain stone free from until the next time slave revolt. Out.
Like a dog, talk a news.